in South America until maybe a maximum of 20,000 or 25,000 years.
Yep.
So at 300,000 years, the archaeologist in charge of the site said, we can't publish that. So Virginia Steen McIntyre and her colleagues independently published their dating of the site, and they got a really harsh negative reaction from their colleagues in the scientific world because they had dared to publish something like that that was just completely different from anything they had been thinking. So for many years, the site just dropped out of the picture. But later, I was involved with a television special called The Mysterious Origins of Man. And I had the producers get in touch with Virginia, and they went down there and they filmed, and it was part of the documentary that aired on NBC. And because of that, new investigations were opened up at the site. And I put Sam Van Landingham in touch with the project, and he got involved in it. Like you say, these diatoms, they're single-celled creatures that have a skeleton made of hard silica. And, you know, they kind of look like snowflakes. They're all different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, each one is different. So each diatom is different. And it's like you said, a diatom expert knows that in a certain time period in the past, particular types of diatoms were there. So Sam did a diatom analysis of the formations at Huayatlaco, and he confirmed that the diatom evidence supported the original dating by Virginia Steen McIntyre and her colleagues. So it's kind of interesting.
Absolutely. I find this stuff so fascinating. And that's why we wanted to get a sample, you know, of that mud, that conglomerate. Because for sure, there's going to be diatoms in it. And for sure, it can tell you how old that footprint is. That plus a good casting. We put out a press release when we got back. And it was just completely ignored, of course. But we did put one out and thought, you know, hey, we've really contributed, you know, to what's going on. We even put a special thank you in there to you. And just sort of ignored. So I'm looking to see, or we're ready to start the show. Actually, I've kind of keyed things in already, but I need to just make sure that everything is broadcasting the way it's supposed to. So give me just a second, Michael, and we'll be at a point where we can get some things going here. All right, I'll be right back.
Okay.
All right, thanks for waiting. So,
how long will we be on live?
It's supposed to be a 2-hour show, so we'll see how it goes.
Okay.
All right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you off screen for a minute. I'm going to start the show, and I'll be back in about 2 or 3 minutes, okay?
All right.
All right, thank you, Michael. Okay, here we go. We're going to start the show, folks. Hello, everyone. And thank you for watching this evening. Of course, it's the Jerry Will Show. And our guest this evening is a really special person to Kathy and I. He wrote the definitive book that has been in our backpack across quite a few continents and has been a real inspiration, both as a person, because of his accomplishments, and also because of the things that he's written. It's inspiring. Our guest tonight is Michael Cremo. And we're going to be talking about a great number of things. You know, when you start talking about forbidden archaeology, it's a very vast and wide field. I know many of you are interested in this, and of course, Kathy and I are very interested in it. So, without any further delay, let's bring our guest on, Michael Cremo. How you doing, Michael?
Pretty good, Jerry. Good to be with you again.
It's really good to have you on the show again, Michael. We were talking ahead of the show. The last time you were with us, where I was actually talking to you on a show, was during the Kevin Smith show. And that's been over a decade ago. Kevin has sadly passed since then. But I was hosting the show for him while he was at a convention. And gosh, I've never forgotten that interview. I don't have a copy of it, but I've never forgotten it. It was absolutely spectacular, very inspiring. You've written the book Forbidden Archaeology. I believe it was 1993. Is that right?
That's when it was published. The writing of it took 8 years.
Oh.
So it was written in the late 1980s and early 1990s.
Wow. Well, it certainly is an ambitious book. I mean, it's like thick, like a nice juicy steak. It's, yeah. What, 400 pages or so, isn't it?
900.
Oh, my God.
That's what some people call it, forbidding archaeology.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the reason why it took so long to read through it. It did take me a few years. And there's plenty of notes in the margins, too. What got you to the point where you thought you should write a book like this? What was the impetus behind it?
Well, you'd probably have to trace it back to my background. My father was a military intelligence officer, and you know, that meant a few things for our family as I was growing up. And one thing it meant was traveling to a lot of different places in the world and in the United States and getting exposed to a lot of different cultures and worldviews. And when I started looking into these different worldviews, I became especially attracted to the worldview of ancient India, which I felt some resonance with. And the writings, the Vedic texts of ancient India contain histories that tell of human populations existing on this planet millions of years ago. And it's something that you find in many other wisdom traditions as well, North American, Indian, cosmologies, Australian Aboriginal cosmologies, practically all of the different ancient wisdom traditions had this idea that humans have been around since the beginning. So I thought, well, is that just some mythology or is there perhaps some factual basis for it? So that's what got me looking into the history of archaeology. Of course, you look in the current textbooks, you're only going to find the evidence that supports the currently dominant ideas.
Yeah.
But again, maybe because of my background, maybe because I grew up among people in the intelligence services, I understood that there's often more to things than you can see on the surface. There are things going on in this world that most people just aren't familiar with or don't know about. So I decided, let me look a little bit deeper. Because the current theories are that human beings like us came into existence less than 200,000 or 300,000 years ago. So when I looked into the history of archaeology, I found that if you look at the original scientific reports, not today's textbooks, but the original scientific reports of archaeologists, geologists, other scientists who are digging into the earth, you find many reports of human bones, human artifacts, human footprints that go very far back in time, much further than the current theories allow. So I kind of concluded, well, yes, the evidence is there for extreme human antiquity, but it's been filtered out. You know, it just, although it's there, the artifacts are in the museums, they're just not talked about, they're not written about, because it doesn't fit, you know, the current theories.
Yeah, well, we've run into that quite a bit. One of the things that Kathy, my wife, has come up with is how archaeology, basically in its very early beginnings, was meant to support, the Bible, basically. It's supposed to support the whole notion that there is God and creation and so on and so on, and that something that goes back so far isn't acceptable. You know, you go back a million years or several million years, that doesn't fit with the doctrines of creation. Was it creationism?
Young Earth creation.
Yeah, exactly. And so there were things that were found in the United States, which I'm certain, and I know you're aware of, that were actually just sort of put off to the side or even destroyed so that the narrative could be reinforced so that it would support, you know, what they were wanting to put forward. But we've seen things, like you have too, I'm sure, that are so remarkably old that it doesn't fit that narrative, and yet no one wants to hear it, and no one, at least in academia, wants anything to do with it. I'm sure you've run into that.
Yeah, but, you know, fortunately, I think there are a few people, even within academia, who are willing to listen to alternatives. They kind of understand that their discipline has been used to, as you say, support a narrative. Mainly, a little bit later, they were mostly trying to justify their conquest of different people in different parts of the world. You know, during the colonial period, there. Mm-hmm. Science was used to suppress the worldviews of people in Asia and Africa and South America, like what the Spanish conquistadors did to the Aztecs and the Mayans.
Sure.
They destroyed all their, practically all, not fortunately not, every single piece of literature that they had. There are some few samples left. But so there is a group within archaeology that's willing to listen to alternatives. Now, whether they're going to accept it or not, that's another question. But because of that, I've been able to make presentations at major international scientific conferences on archaeology, like meetings of the World Archaeological Congress and the European Association of Archaeologists. So, but there is also a group of people that think, in those disciplines, that think we've got it, you know, we've got the answers, this is real science. Everything else is pseudoscience, and they don't want to hear what I have to say. They don't want anyone else to hear it. And, you know, if I'm scheduled to give a lecture at some university, maybe they'll try to get it canceled. So that kind of thing happens too. I mean, and if it didn't happen, I really couldn't call my topic forbidden archaeology if I didn't get forbidden every once in a while.
Yeah, valid point, Michael. You've got another book you're writing. What's the name of the next book you're writing?
Well, the title, the provisional title is Extreme Human Antiquity. And what this particular book is about is the discoveries that have come to my attention since the earlier book was published, Forbidden Archaeology. So I'm going to collect all that, and, you know, that'll be the subject matter of this new book, which, you know, I expect to see out early next year. So that's one good thing about the pandemic. It's given me some time to work on it, because if I'm jetting all over the world, going here, going there, to Europe, to India, to other places, I kind of get distracted. You know, it's kind of hard to focus on the writing.
Yeah,
that's one good result of the different lockdowns and restrictions on travel and public lectures and things like that. Although things are starting to open up a little bit. And I've done a couple of public lectures this year and hope to be doing some more.
Well, I'd certainly be interested. Maybe you should have these things broadcast live. I'm sure a lot of folks would be interested in catching that.
Well, I think some of them are live streamed, like the Earth Origins conference that I attended and spoke at in Sedona, Arizona a few mm-hmm. weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
That was live streamed. And early next year in April, well, in the spring, April 1 through 4, I'm scheduled to speak at a conference at Mount Shasta in Northern California. And I think that's going to be a hybrid conference, live and in person, plus live stream.
So, mm-hmm. Oh, good luck with all that. I wish you all the best with it. Do you have any significant little crumbs you can throw out about what you have in your next book?
Well, I kind of introduce the topic with the idea that there are scientists who are willing to consider the concept of extreme human antiquity, at least as a thought experiment or a hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there were a couple of astrophysicists who were wondering about environmental questions, really. You know, they say, okay, our Earth, because of, we've polluted the atmosphere with different greenhouse gases, that we've created a climate crisis that could just wipe out our whole civilization. So they were wondering among themselves, well, what about other star systems and planets? Because with, you know, modern astronomy, you know, the space telescopes and things like that, they've been able to identify Earth-like planets in orbits around stars and other solar systems and other parts of our galaxy. So actually they've calculated that there's tens of thousands of such Earth-like planets and habitable zones around the stars that they're orbiting. So they wondered, okay, let's analyze the atmospheres of these planets and see if we can detect, the presence of these greenhouse gases, which would be an indication of ancient civilizations. Because according to their calculations, it can take millions of years for the light from these distant star systems to reach us.
Right.
So I have to take, I have to plug in my power.
You froze up. Still with us? Well, it looks like Michael's feed has frozen.
Yeah, plug in.
He had to plug in his power. Maybe it's a power overload.
Yeah, plug in.
I think he's trying to figure out what to do about it, though. No, that's me moving the cursor. All right. Let's see what we can figure out here. Might have to call him back, folks. Oh, good heavens. Well, we just went to a very wacky looking screen, didn't we? All right. I'm sure we'll get him back. There's a time tunnel you're looking at there.
It's like the mirrors of ever.
Here to forever. That's exactly right.
Mirrors forever. Oh my gosh.
That's pretty wild, isn't it? Still waiting for Michael to show back up. Stand by, everyone. I have no idea what's going on. One thing, just so you know, they have had some. They're up in the Northwest. Michael is. If you've heard recently, they've had some very severe flooding and power outages. And it has affected Michael and where he's broadcasting from. There might have been something that has happened that he has no way of remedying. But what I'm going to do, I'm going to shut this down and restart it and see if we can get him back on here again, see if that is even possible. If not, then we'll have to be happy with what we've got and take it from there. So just hang on, everyone. All right, let's just shut this down and restart it. Nope, no, he's not there. All right. So I guess what we're going to do. Any idea how many folks are watching, Kat?
Four
people?
Counted me.
Count the three.
There's three people and me.
Well, there'd be a lot more people, though, afterwards. You know.
RJ's there. RJ Kraken.
RJ McCracken. How you doing, RJ? Who else do we have there, Cap? And I'll keep an eye out here. Michael gets back on here, then we'll certainly get him back on immediately. It's usually my system that's screwing up. So although I feel badly for Michael that something has happened at his end, I do feel relieved it isn't anything with our end. Because that would be a hair puller, wouldn't it? Who else do we have there, Kat? Did you?
Doesn't say.
It doesn't say? All right.
Just RJ and me and nobody else commented.
And nobody else commented. All right. One of the things, of course, I started this broadcast while I was still getting things set up. And I don't know if you came in too late to hear it or not, but one of the things we were talking about was the footprints that Kathy discovered the location of in Bolivia. And I let Michael know he was instrumental in pushing that button for us to go and look and investigate it. And, of course, she subsequently found the one footprint we were looking for had been sought out. And I guess it was sought out by archaeologists. We didn't know who sought it out. And the people of this little village, they were just devastated when they found out it was gone. Because they were under the impression, and had a firm belief, that this footprint was a relic from their ancestors. And so we wanted to know more about that, of course. And we did look into it.
Brent's listening.
Hello, Brent. Glad you're here. So when we found the other two footprints, well, Kathy found them, I didn't. We let the folks of the village know that there were two more footprints up there, and we told them where to go look. So at least they had that. I've been told that the footprint has been found again, and now it's apparently back in the museum in La Paz. If we ever get the ability to travel again, we're definitely going to go to La Paz and take a look at that. And, of course, if you guys want to come along, we'd love to have you with us. One of the things that was real interesting about this, the footprint that, oh, wait a second, we have something happening here. There he is. And get a video and we'll be all set. Anyway, one of the things that we discovered about the footprint, prints actually, we discovered on top of that mountain in Bolivia, there is a very interesting genetic trait the Aymara Indians have. And I'll tell you about that in a second. Michael, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Somehow or other, my computer just crashed.
Well, don't feel bad. It happened to me during a show just a few days ago. So it's sunspots. That's what we always say.
Yeah. It's to reboot and get back on. So I apologize for that.
No, it's quite all right. Believe me, I mean, if you've been watching the shows that I produce, this is just normal territory, Michael.
Yeah.
You know, it's like walking around an ancient graveyard. Snap, what was that? Oh, no, I broke a femur.
Oops.
Yeah, I was just telling folks, and then we'll go back on what you were saying so I can finish this up, that there is a real specific genetic characteristic in the Aymara Indians in that region where we found the footprints. You and I were talking about it earlier. It's right. That their toe on the left foot, the toe next to the big toe has a curve to it. And you take a look at the Aymara Indians, they all have this. It's just a very slight little thing that there is there. The footprints that we found on top of that mountain had that going for it. And I don't remember if the sandstone that was cut out, if that footprint had it or not, but it seems like it did. And so it was like maybe these people, because they were saying they'd been there forever. Now, we know that's probably not true, but then again, I mean, maybe it is. Because that small little indication in the way their foot shaped was the same in those footprints that Kathy found, and I think it was the same in that sandstone impression that was cut out. So anyway, folks, that's what I was getting at. And you know, if you have any comments on that, Michael, go right ahead.
Well, I do. You know, you were asking, before I dropped out, if there were anything I could share from the new book, and those footprints are definitely an interesting discovery that was made after I published Forbidden Archaeology, so I'm definitely including that case in the book as an example of possible human presence in the Miocene period, which extends from about 5 million to 20 million years ago. So it's a really interesting case of footprint evidence for a human presence in very, very ancient times. And, you know, I had been describing the overall concept of the book, which is called Extreme Human Antiquity. And I mentioned that there were a couple of astrophysicists who were interested in the possibility of civilizations existing on other planets and other solar systems millions of years ago. And they also began to consider, well, maybe there was, what if there was a very ancient civilization, technologically advanced human civilization that existed on Earth 400 million years ago, let's say, in what's called the Silurian period. And, you know, they had gotten this idea from an old British science fiction series called Dr. No that aired on BBC. So, in one of the episodes of this Dr. No science fiction series, some scientists were investigating some disturbances at a nuclear power plant, and they were digging. They were excavating under it to see what the source of this disturbance was. And when they got down, they found some caverns, and in it they found some reptilian humanoid creatures that had been in a state of suspended animation since the Silurian period, and now they were waking up and doing stuff. So that's where they got the idea for what they call the Silurian hypothesis. So they decided that, yeah, there may have been a technologically advanced civilization on Earth hundreds of millions of years ago, but it would be very difficult to detect the sign, any evidence for it, because over these vast periods of time, a lot of the sedimentary layers of rock are destroyed because of erosion, plate tectonics, and things like that. So that would mean probably there would be very little fossil evidence for it or any kinds of artifacts that would be left. What you might be able to detect, they said, would be the presence of isotopes, you know, different versions of different elements that are created only in some very extreme circumstances, like nuclear explosions and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they suggest maybe that's what we should be looking for. Yeah, and that would take a different kind of analysis. You have to do some very careful studies of minerals and see if you could detect any of these elements or compounds that would be produced by either highly technologically advanced chemical work or by a nuclear explosion or something like that. So, you know, that's an example of, you know, some mainstream scientists that are willing to consider at least the possibility that there may have been advanced human civilizations on this planet in the very distant past.
Huh.
And I think there's definitely evidence for a human presence going very far back in time, but the further back in time you go, the evidence becomes more and more rare. And because, not because there wasn't any evidence, but because over the course of these vast periods of time, it gets destroyed.
Well, yeah, that's pretty evident. I mean, you, if I remember correctly, cause it's been several years since I read Forbidden Archaeology, but there was a part in there about a gold chain, wasn't there? That was
there were some extreme anomalies.
Like it was the very gold old chain.
Yeah, it was found in. The story of that was there was a woman in. Living in Illinois in the late 19th century, and she was putting some coal into a coal-burning stove.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the pieces of coal was very big, so she broke it in half with a hammer. And inside the piece of coal, she found a gold chain. And the original report gave information about the mine that it came from. So using that information, we were able to determine that the coal from that mine is about 300 million years old. And there are actually other objects or human skeletal remains that have been found in coal deposits that, according to modern geology, are at least 300 million years old. Like you had the Macoupin County skeleton. Macoupin County is near, it's in Illinois, but it's near St. Louis, Missouri. And in the year 1852, a scientific journal called The Geologist published a report that a human skeleton had been found 90 feet below the surface of the ground in undisturbed coal deposits. And that would mean if the skeleton is in place, in situ, as they call it, in those deposits, it would be the remains of a human that existed 300 million years ago. So these days, we don't get so many reports of discoveries of objects or bones being found in coal because in the modern mining techniques, they have these machines that just chew up
right
the coal. Anything inside gets destroyed. But the miners using the older methods in the beginning of the 20th century and the 19th century and earlier, they would often report finding human remains, human bones, human artifacts, and ancient coal deposits. Of course, well, not very.
It just makes you wonder, you know, there are obviously huge potentials for civilizations to have existed here and risen and fallen hundreds of times. And yet, we look at ourselves, we really can't place ourselves into that greater dynamic picture because we don't know anything about it, which is what makes what you've done so valuable. It gives us a lineage.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting. You know, Plato, in his work called The Timaeus, recounts how the Greek political philosopher Solon, he was a lawgiver, Solon, he went to Egypt, and he was speaking with some Egyptian temple priest. And they asked him about the history of the Greek people. So Solon gave the account that he was familiar with. There was a devastation, and then afterwards there was the first human, Deucalion was his name. And then, you know, civilization gradually developed from him.
Mm-hmm.
And the Egyptian priest told them, well, you're just giving the most recent events because there have been many of these devastations that have taken place. And as you were saying, Jerry, civilizations have risen and fallen over the course of vast periods of time. So the Egyptians were saying, you've forgotten all that. You just know what's happened after the last cosmic devastation or flood or whatever it was.
Sure.
And we have the records of what happened with your people in the previous cycles of time before previous devastations that periodically take place. So some people think that these records may be found someday. They're not existing these days, but there is that account from one of Plato's works.
Well, that's kind of what Kathy and I were trying to do in South America because we felt that there were so many anomalous sites down there. That whoever made some of these places, it had to have been in a far-reaching aspect of antiquity. And, you know, I mean, you would figure if they were that advanced of a culture that they would have records, and so we were looking to try and locate those records, but we never really succeeded at that. But, you know, I still feel that they're out there, and they're probably in other places on this planet as well, maybe buried under hundreds of feet of rock and sediment, but they're still out there.
Yeah, well, there are some interesting cases from South America that I've written about that support the idea of a very ancient human presence in the Americas. Like, you know, you had the discoveries early in the 20th century made by Carlos Ameghino in Argentina at a place called Miramar. And there he found the bone of an extinct South American mammal called a toxodon. And the interesting thing about this fossilized bone was that it had embedded in it an arrowhead, a stone arrowhead. And, you know, archaeologists believe that only humans like us are using weapons like bows and arrows. They don't think any kind of ape man did that, you know, like Australopithecus or some other supposed human ancestor.
Mm-hmm.
So It was a very controversial discovery because it was found in a formation that is considered to be at least 2 million years old, and perhaps between 2 and 3 million years old. So many scientists just said, okay, you're obviously the victim of a hoax. Obviously what happened here is somebody found a toxodon femur and, you know, or thigh bone, and they got an arrowhead from some fairly recent Indian village site, archaeological site, and they pounded the arrowhead into the bone, and then they put the bone into the formation, into the excavation for you to find. And, you know, Carlos Almaguino said, okay, let's get together a group of archaeologists, geologists, and other scientists to do a new investigation at this site. And the skeptics will let you conduct the excavations, and we'll see if we find anything. So the leading skeptic, his name was Eric Beaumont, he came and he engaged in the new excavations. Carlos Almaguino said, you dig where you want to dig and we'll just see. So he chose a place to dig. The excavation was made, and they found further evidence for a human presence in this formation in the form of bola stones, which are brown stones with a groove around the equator. Mm-hmm. And you take a couple of them and you attach them to a cord, you know, made of leather or plant material or whatever, and you use it as a weapon to capture or kill small animals, birds, things like that. And they found these things solidly embedded in the undisturbed formation, and they were photographed in place. And, you know, it was a very high standard, you know, because that, you know, that's something that scientists often say to me, well, you know, the modern standard is you photograph everything in place and you show geologically that the layers are undisturbed. So they did all that. A case from, you know, South America, evidence for extreme human antiquity there. Of course, then you've also got the Mayan calendar that has vast periods of time, and obviously they thought that humans were present throughout these vast periods of time and that are laid out in the Mayan calendar.
Well, they had the same thing over in India, right?
Yes. And they have a cyclical concept of time. And when I was in Sedona recently for the Earth Origins Conference, I kind of touched on some connections between the ancient Asian Indian ideas and the North American Native people's ideas about the time cycles. And the ancient Asian Indian cosmology, they accept there's a cycle of four ages, and the cycle repeats again and again and again, like the seasons of the year. Every year there's spring, summer, fall, winter, and then you go to another spring, summer, fall, winter, and another, and another. And just like in the seasons, things get progressively colder. Mm-hmm. So in the course of the passing of these ages, human values begin to degrade. You know, in the first age, called the Satyayuga, everything is wonderful, spiritual, peaceful. Everybody gets along with each other. And then in the next stage, things begin to deteriorate a little bit. People begin to divide themselves into different groups, compete with each other. And then in the next stage, you get warfare, you know, huge wars breaking out. And finally, in the fourth age, which we're in now, according to the Vedic cosmological calendar, it's called the Age of Kali. It's predicted and described as being an age of increasing social and environmental disturbance, which we do see all around us. So the symbolically, sometimes this progression of ages is described as a bull with four legs. And with each passing age, the bull is left standing with one less leg. So you start out, the bull is standing with four legs, and then the next age on three legs. The next age starts with the bull standing on two legs. And the current age that we're in now starts with the bull standing on one leg. Now, the North American native peoples, like the Sioux and the Hopi and Zuni, many of them have the idea of the white buffalo calf lady, who is like a goddess, and she comes to explain things to people, and she says, there are four ages, and there's a buffalo, a white buffalo. He's standing on four legs, and with the passing of each age, he loses a leg. Same thing, you know, as the Asian Indian concept, the Vedic concept. Of course, instead of a bull, they've got a buffalo.
Sure.
With each passing age, the buffalo loses a leg. And according to their understanding, we're in the fourth age, which is an age of disturbance. So, you know, it's interesting to see these parallels between
absolutely
these wisdom systems.
What is the duration of time from the beginning to the end of these four ages? Do you know?
Well, there are cycles within cycles within cycles. Mm-hmm. From the Vedic system, as described in the Puranas, which are the historical and cosmological writings of ancient India, a cycle of four yugas, four ages, lasts 4,320,000 years. And you take 1,000 of those cycles of four yugas, you get what's called a kalpa. And that, or day of Brahma, sometimes it's called. And that lasts 4,320,000 years.
Wow.
And the day of Brahma is followed by a night of Brahma that lasts the same period of time. So according to the Vedic cosmology, during the days of Brahma, life, including human life, is manifest in the universe, in the cosmos. And during the nights of Brahma, everything kind of goes on pause. You know, it's like you're put in a dormant condition. All the living beings are put into a dormant state. And then when the next day comes, they become active again. and the cycles just go on and on and on. So in a sense, there's no creation because it's always going on. You know, so it's not exactly a creationist view. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Now, what I found interesting is that there was a Native American scholar called Vine Deloria, and he wrote a book called Red Earth, White Lies, in which he extensively and very positively cited and included passages from forbidden archaeology, because he said that the North American, Native American people, we don't think that we came over from Alaska, from Siberia over a land bridge to Alaska 20,000 years ago.
Sure.
And we don't accept this idea that humans appeared really recently, as modern science says, within the past 200,000 or 300,000 years. And he was giving examples of legends from Native American tribal people connected with datable geological events. Now, for example, there's Mount Hood in the state of Oregon. So there are legends from the local tribal people there that once that Mount Hood was so high that its shadow extended for the distance that a man could walk in an entire day. And according to the Indian people, the Native Americans, that would be about 50 miles or something. So that mountain doesn't make a shadow that big today. But if you study the geological history of it, you'll see that about 100,000 years ago, there was a huge eruption that destroyed the part of the mountain, Mount Hood, its peak. It was blown off so that the mountain that exists today is smaller than the one that existed 100,000 years ago. And the tribal legends describe how, yes, the mountain used to be very big. It used to cast a very long shadow, but it doesn't today because they say evil spirits were dwelling within the mountain. They caused it to explode, and this lava came out and drove all the people away. And that's why the mountain isn't as big as it was before. And factually speaking, there was such an eruption 100,000 years ago. And Vine Deloria was suggesting that there were Native American people present 100,000 years ago in the region of Mount Hood. So he kind of liked forbidden archaeology because it sort of accepted this idea that that many of the North American people have, that they've been present here for a long time.
Let me take a short pause here. For you folks who are listening on the radio feed, that concludes the first hour. I want to thank you for listening. And if you want to catch the entire show, including the video, you can do that at jerrywillshow.com. Where you're at right now listening, most likely, it's in the members area. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a comment. Subscriptions and your comments cost nothing, but it really helps us out a lot. To hear the entire interview you were just listening to and many, many other amazing interviews within our archives, please visit jerrywillshow.com and become a member. Your membership supports our ongoing broadcasts. That's jerrywillsshow.com. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this program.